Start. We're going to start. We are recording this meeting of the Legislative Reentry Working Group. I'd like to thank everyone for your willingness to participate. And this is sort of our, it's obviously our first meeting, and it'll be up to this group to decide how many more meetings we have and how much we can accomplish. You should all have an agenda that was that we put together, and we were hoping to finish around 4:35 o'clock and then set another time. Hopefully have two or three more meetings in the next couple of months. What I'd also like to do is to first have the working group members introduce themselves and what you do, and then maybe have staff and others who are in the audience quickly introduce themselves, and then we'll get right into the agenda. So, Senator, why don't we? I'm State Representative Michael Tamar, and I chair the Public Safety Finance Committee and represent the City of St. Paul.
And I'm State Senator Linda Higgins. I represent part of Minneapolis, and I chair the Senate Public Safety Budget Committee.
And I'm Isabel Gomez. I'm the Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. For 23 years, I was a judge in Hennepin County, so I say mostly I've been a frog in the laboratory.
I'm Andy Erickson. I'm Deputy Director responsible for Adult Probation in Ramsey County.
Kevin Kyer, the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense.
I'm Rob Eastland. I'm a State Representative from District 17A. That's basically Isani County, and I've served on the Public Safety Committee for, I think, 5 years now.
And I'll be co-chair of this committee on the House side.
I'm Janet Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division in the Department for 33-plus years.
I'm Gary Johnson. I'm the Director of Reentry Services for the Department of Corrections.
I'm Jeff Schwab. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator with the Minnesota Judicial Branch.
I'm Dan Kane. I'm with an organization called RSE that provides services to people who have made poor decisions in their life and as a result are suffering the consequences of.
Yeah, and maybe just quickly, if people in the audience here could just introduce themselves so we know who's here. Just real quickly go around there.
Chris Turner, County Fiscal Analyst. Patrick Baldwin, Representative Mallory, CA, Public Safety School Investigation.
Melanie McComb, CA, for Public Safety Finance in the House.
Gary Carter, Fiscal Analyst, House.
Would you mind committee vice president?
Mary Creason, City Court, House.
Okay. I don't know where to start, somewhere back there.
Patrick?
I'm Patrick Wood. I'm the State Policy Advocate for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Steve Thomas, the Chief Executive of the Network for Better Futures.
Kate Reed, CFO of the Church of the House.
Over here.
Megan Johnson, CFO of Senate Research.
Linnea Michelson, Senate Republican Research.
Eric Highland, representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and Minnesota Chiefs Police Association.
Here I am, representing
Metropolitan Cities. Harvey Anderson with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership.
My name is Dan Canusa, representing the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the Drug Policy Reform.
Jacqueline
Krause,
I'm a researcher
with the Public Safety Budget. Very good. Well, thanks. Did anyone want to address the working group? I thought if anyone did, maybe we would carve out 10 minutes at the end of the meeting. But if does anyone? Okay.
Something might come up.
If something does come up, yeah. Okay. So with that, I'd also like to just say to Libby and to Libby Wyrum, she put together this for the working group. If anyone would like a copy, this is everything related to reentry in the state of Minnesota that's been published. So,
wow.
You can have your own copy, Dennis.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mr. Chair, yes. I went to the NCSL reentry conference about a month ago, and I came back with several things to prisoner health and the health of the public, developing an action agenda for prisoners reentering the community, felony convictions and access to health care, equal opportunity for life and liberty, public safety, public spending, forecasting prison populations, mental health in the prisons, prisoner reentry and the lack of substance abuse treatment coverage, avoiding jail pays off, the state mental health lawmakers' digest. So,
well, maybe you can, we can have copies made of some of that anyway.
Maybe order some more.
Okay.
Chairman, I brought extra invitations to our legislative forum next week, to which everybody here is invited. And because it is about building futures of those people who made big mistakes.
Very good. Thank you. You know, we don't have a lot of time, so this is the agenda. If you have some ideas on other things we should add to it. What we thought we'd do is have the Department of Corrections make a brief presentation on current reentry efforts that are being utilized, and then have Dan Kane talk a little bit, bring us up to date on some of the work that the network's been doing. And then, I'm not sure if you see this on your agenda. Do you have copies of your agenda? We may not have a copy of the bill, actually, but there are like 10 different areas that we were charged with examining. And one is, I'll just quickly go through these, the DOC's role in offender reentry, housing for ex-offenders, including the role of DHS and the Department of Housing Finance, pre- and post-release offender drug treatment programs and funding, drug sentencing, including adjusting the drug weight threshold, early discharge committee or parole board, establishing reentry courts, probation, collateral sanctions, juvenile offender reentry. In talking with Representative Eastland, we were talking about some way of maybe narrowing this down to 3 or 4 or 5 different areas that we really want to. I don't think we can do it all. And one of our goals is to draft some legislation for the next legislative session. Whether we actually act on that or not will determine, a lot of things will determine that, but maybe we need to narrow the scope of this working group to a few of these different topic areas, and I'm not sure which ones those are. Representative Eastland and I were also talking about having, you know, maybe it's this group or maybe it's an ongoing group, but that something with the legislature and all of you who are working in this area, that we continue to meet on an ongoing basis and not just over the interim, because these issues aren't going to go away. And then the final thing I would ask is that at some point we think about whether there should be additional representation on this committee. I think it's good to keep it relatively small, but I can see there's a few people in this audience that maybe should be on here, and I'd leave that up to the group. So, any other ideas? Okay. All right, then. So, why don't we start with Gary Johnson from DOC, if you want to just bring us up to date a little bit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've passed out to the members of the work group here a couple of DOC backgrounders that are just kind of an outline of what I'm going to talk about real briefly here. The first one is called Facility Reentry Programming. I'm not going to go over that in any detail, but just to let you know that the department has been involved in offender reentry programming for longer than we have had a reentry initiative. And some of the things that we do at our institutions are highlighted in this backgrounder. We have, you know, identified the fact that proper identification for offenders is a very crucial issue, and we've taken steps to ensure that we get as many IDs to those offenders who are being released as we can. We do pre-release classes that are mandatory for our offenders at the 6-month point from their release. It's a 3-day program. We have a class book that is very, very extensive and very well done, and I think I could bring that to the group if you don't already have it. Chairman Beamer, there it is. Okay. But we've identified a number of those things that are important for reentry as offenders are nearing their release date, where we do employment seminars with offenders at most of our institutions. Excuse me, we have resource fairs that we carry on, where we bring in programs from the community so that offenders can actually meet face to face with some of the people that might be able to serve them when they are released. That's just a quick outline of some of the things that we do. There's a second page, and in the interest of time here, I'm not going to go into a whole lot of that. The second backgrounder that I have here is just a description of the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Plan, MCORP. This is our reentry initiative where we are asking other state agencies to collaborate with us and sit on a steering committee to oversee the business that we do in the way of a reentry initiative. We have a number of different agencies who sit on that steering committee. That's outlined in the lower right-hand corner of the first page of your backgrounder. And I'm just going to jump real quickly to, because I've given this presentation, I think, to a number of people here, and I don't want to put you all to sleep here. It's kind of late in the afternoon. but some of the things that we have accomplished at this point is to ask each of our three pilot counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted, to create advisory groups in each of their counties so that we can get some local community input into what the issues of reentry are in each of those three counties. And those advisory groups are meeting and about to meet in all three of those counties. We've also now, with the budget that we received from an appropriation from the legislature this year, have money that we are granting each of the three pilot counties, broken down basically by population for those three counties. And we've just put out a grant notice and are going to get responses from those three counties as to what kind of business they're going to be doing with gaps that they observe in their three counties. We are also asking that each of those three counties participate with us in better assessments that we do in our institutions and case planning, which is at the core of doing good reentry work in our correction system. We've gotten away from case plans in the past, and we're going to go back to the use of case plans so that we actually have a process that involves the offender and works on those issues that he and correction staff identify as important for that person to be able to stay out once they're released. Some of the other things that we're working on currently are a number of grants that the legislature appropriated money for this past spring. There are three reentry grants, one for an employment service in North Minneapolis, one for domestic violence treatment and counseling for victims of domestic abuse, a mentoring of children of incarcerated parents grant, and then a high-risk adult contract to provide wraparound services for offenders once they're released, so that it's offender-centered programming for those offenders that meet the qualifications of that program. That RFP is in the process right now. We have a deadline for proposals for September 18th. We will probably make an award by late October. That high-risk adult contract will begin on December 1st of this year. The other three reentry grants that I mentioned, the deadline has come and gone on those. We have their proposals, and we are this week evaluating those proposals and going to be making awards for those three grants. So that will be done, I think, by early next week. And so those programs that are awarded grants will be able to be up and running by sometime this fall. I'm moving kind of quickly, and I've got a number of things to cover. If people have questions, I'll be glad to answer any questions you have.
I have a question on that case plan thing, Gary. Obviously, or not obviously, but in fact, there's pretty wide agreement that having a case plan for every convicted person as soon as possible is a good idea. And a rather disturbing reality that we're encountering in our agency is that there seems to be a dropping off in the completion of pre-sentence investigations.
Yeah.
I find this troubling because I don't even know how you sentence appropriately without a pre-sentence investigation. And that would be there are two parts. There's a worksheet about computing people's criminal history, and everybody does that all the time. And then there is a legislatively mandated, I think, pre-sentence investigation, which is a very valuable tool and has all kinds of things, realities about this person. So are you seeing that? And if so, how does that impact your ability to do a case plan?
Yes, I am seeing that. I used to write PSIs for you, as a matter of fact. I think it's been an issue of volume in a number of counties, and I certainly understand what that process brings to being able to do a PSI on every offender that is sentenced in district court. But it does bring a distinct problem for the Department of Corrections in being able to have accurate information other than self-reported information from the offender that we can use to develop assessments and eventually the case plan for that person. So yes, I see
and
the same problem.
That's required on all felonies.
Well, it is. But it isn't getting done, it appears.
Is it required by statute on all felonies, Becky?
And, you know, when you talk about self-reporting, one of the most fascinating things about felons in particular is that despite the fact that people believe in the abuse excuse, they don't. That's not how they talk about themselves. So if a guy is talking about his history, he had a wonderful life, his mother was terrific, his grandmother was a sweetie, everything was wonderful. And it is in the investigation that you find out, you know, his dad was in prison and his mother's boyfriend was abusive and he hasn't talked to his sister for 30 years and whatever. So it's really troubling to think you don't have that information.
We agree.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, I would say that we have had the same problem in our prison system with case plans, and it really is driven by volume. As Gary said, we went through this period of exorbitant growth where I think the same thing happened in prison, it happened in the community. The PSI became the worksheet, and in the prison system, our case plan became a similar kind of worksheet. So I think we've both been remiss in terms of trying to put forth good information to make good decisions around, and I hate to start playing the Ain't It Awful violin so early in this process, but it really was driven by workload and numbers, and we went through a 10-year period where our prison system doubled in size, our beds. So I think we're starting to get caught up a little bit, and we're becoming aware of these gaps in the system, but that is real fundamental. We can't make good decisions if we don't get good decisions. And I think if we're going to be successful in this initiative, information is really going to be a key piece.
So, what do you think?
Well, I'm saying that I think it has to become a priority for counties, and I think it has to become a priority for our casework staff, too. We are in the process of retooling in trying to develop a case plan once they hit the institution that's a little bit more sophisticated than what we're dealing with right now. If We spend an awful lot of time on assessments when they come in, but then the case report is a bunch of checks and boxes, and we, you know, 26, 7 years ago, I was a caseworker, and I did, you know, case plans that were 7 or 8 pages. Lots and lots of information on these people, and they went before a parole board, and they had, you know, an inch of material, not only from us, but from the county as well, in which to make a good informed decision. And you know, our population in the prison system at that time was around 800, and now we're at 9,100. I'm not saying that that's what kept us out of all this trouble, but I think it's one of those things. It's the old, you can't make good decisions if you don't have good information, and it really is, I think, a good place to start.
And any of us who are old enough to remember the case summary, and I certainly am, appreciated the information that was in that case summary that the case manager did, caseworker at that time, because I was a parole agent, field agent in Hennepin County at that time, and used that case plan as a way of developing my own case plan once that offender was released. So it's an important document, and it's very important information. How we can get that information as completely as we used to is the trick.
Why is it so important now? I mean, if we don't have a parole board, I mean, what's the who would that be useful for? Post incarceration.
At the front end, Representative Tim, our chairman, it's hugely important to judges. I mean, at least it was to me. If I'm making a decision, most of the people that judges sentence
I'm not
go on
talking
probation.
About the sentence investigations. I'm talking about the case plans that they're developing.
I mean,
this is sort of the argument around determinate and indeterminate sentencing and the fact that we don't have a parole board.
I don't think so, because I think that when best practices are articulated lately, pretty much what they're saying is that a case plan is developed immediately post-conviction, and that case plan is used for that individual wherever he may be, as long as he is within the criminal justice system. So at the front end, it might be used to guide probation decisions, and then if he gets revoked, presumably you're still looking at those same issues and like that. So the case plan is enormously important if we're going to do evidence-based practice, either in terms of decision-making at the parole level or on reentry or in the prison or whatever. I mean, so, in fact, I would argue that those uses are much more significant than a parole board, which is just in or out. I mean, we're talking about how do you work with this offender so as to maximize his ability to function
in
society.
And beyond that, the case plan is, by best practices, an interactive document and a dynamic document that changes as issues for the offender change, and requires the offender's involvement in creating that case plan. If you have an inmate's involvement in what his plan will be, and he voluntarily is involved in that process, the chances of his release being successful go up dramatically at that point. So it's really National Institute of Corrections, it calls it best practice to use a case plan as a stable of reentry initiative in any state.
Chairman, I just had a question earlier on the PSI. Do you see that, or the lack thereof? Do you see it as an urban-rural issue? Because that's where we're seeing it, is a lot of the more rural areas just don't have the resources, but have this big growth in numbers of cases. I mean, the 9th District comes to mind right away, the 9th Judicial District.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't be expert enough to talk about it statewide, but I can talk about it in the metropolitan area, and I know that it is an issue in the larger counties of the metropolitan area. volume causes it to be something that is short-circuited because they need to handle cases that are moving through the court system. So frequently a PSI is bypassed in order to do something in a more quick fashion.
Do you want to speak directly to this, Dan?
Well, I was just going to say, Representative Tamar, that a case plan is, you know, it's a plan for addressing the needs that the person needs when they come in the institution, but it's also a release plan for when they come out. And, you know, to Isabel's point over here, you know, offenders tend to be pretty crafty people, and it depends on what the mood of the day is to what they'll tell you. I mean, if we're paying attention to drug treatment, everybody that goes in will have a drug problem. And if we're not paying attention to drug treatment, but you might have to stay in prison longer if you have a drug problem, nobody has a drug problem. It's amazing how that self-reporting thing goes. And the same thing holds true with, you know, if I was abused, if it gets me some play, I was abused all day long. And if I wasn't, hell no, I had a great childhood. And the ability to cut through the BS, so to speak, and spend enough time with an individual and find out what's real versus what's just kind of superficial is what's going to determine whether or not that individual gets the appropriate things addressed either in the institution or once they're in release from the institution. That's the value of the case plan. You know, making sure that people touch the bases that they need to touch to stay out of prison.
And Dennis, do you have, you said you, if I understand it, you want to revamp that. I mean, do you have the staff to do that kind of comprehensive assessment that it sounds like you would like from someone who worked with offenders post-incarceration?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. We've redeployed some staff this past, I think, starting in about March or April to try to front-end load the assessment process up at St. Cloud, and we're doing some analysis of the assessments we do and the order in which we do them, and trying to develop a meaningful and dynamic case plan that will change as, you know, as they get their GED or they complete a vocational training program, or if they have mental health issues that crop up. You know, all of that becomes part of the equation that feeds the ultimate decisions around a release plan. Just because we no longer have a parole board, we still have a hearings and release unit that has to sign on to an adequate release plan. So those ingredients are really important. And you know, if we do good assessments up front, we put together a comprehensive plan, we develop a roadmap for the offender, and then the caseworker can sit down with the agent the way we used to in 1978 and develop a meaningful release plan that ultimately will hopefully hold some of the kinds of reentry must-haves that I think we all know are important. A place to live, release them sober. If they've got mental health issues, that needs to be addressed. Either release them treated or to treatment. And a job, and I think a family, mentor, church, some kind of wraparound services. I don't think it is as complicated sometimes as we tend to make it. I really don't. I think it's what's complicated is to develop that from the front to the back system and do the tracking. And it becomes exacerbated when you throw people in prison that have 6 months, 7 months with the people who have 25 years. So, but I think all of it is doable.
Okay. The essence of
it must be finished up with the case plans and then whatever else you wanted.
Sure, we've been on this quite a while, but I just want to say it's the essence of the MCOR pilot project with the three pilot counties that we have. We're going to roll this out with a limited number of offenders initially because we've got some culture change that needs to go on in our institutions, and to make a broad sweeping change may not be the best way to do this. So we're going to do case plans with a targeted group of offenders initially and then track those offenders as they come out to supervised release in those three pilot counties, study that process, and be able to tell you empirically whether it works or doesn't work.
Okay, now I'd just like to ask a question again. So you're going to revamp the case plans and do that and utilize those with the targeted group in those three counties. So you're not going to do the case plans system-wide?
Not initially. We aren't going to withhold services in our institutions to any offender, but we are going to track whether or not the case plan develops a better plan for release for that offender, and then whether or not the existence of the case plan assists that offender once they're out on release to stay out.
Okay.
Gary, are there any models around the country that have developed a fairly sophisticated case plan management system that we can look at and see and kind of understand that may have covered some of the ground that you're covering now?
Yes. NIC has the Transition from Prison to Community Initiative, TPCI is the acronym for it. They developed a benchmark case plan that they consider as best practices for use with offenders in institutions and upon release. So we're looking at that. There are a few twists to a case plan. We've got probably three that we're looking at this point, but they all really emanate from that NIC model.
Yeah, you want to finish that one?
Is that a large document that would cover that stuff? It would be interesting to maybe if we could see something in print that maybe had some current information about what's happening in this arena around the country.
Yeah, I can produce that for this work group. Yeah.
But is it the Urban Institute that did the complete reentry plan out of New York? I think that's who it is. If you want to learn something, it will put you to sleep many times at night, but it's a Bible about that thick. And we can get you copies of that, too, if it would help.
Gary, why don't you finish up whatever you want to tell us about.
Okay. Some of the other accomplishments that MCOR has done, the state of Minnesota was asked to be one of five states that went to Washington, D.C. this past August to the National Governors Association Reentry Policy Academy. So we went there and got some technical assistance from their Center for Best Practices and picked up a couple of real good pieces of information that we're going to incorporate into our reentry plan. And we'll continue to get technical assistance from the NGA because of our being involved in that policy academy. So I'll move on from there. I could talk a lot longer about that, but I won't.
Actually, move on.
Then we were the recipient just recently of Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance grant, $450,000 to demonstrate best practices for reentry in two of our pilot counties. It wasn't quite enough money to do it in all three, so we picked the two urban counties of Hennepin and Ramsey, and we have a proposal where we're going to put what we call reentry agents who work with the parole units in those two counties to do some in-reach with offenders in our institutions and then do, for lack of a better way to put it, a little hand-holding with those people when they first get out, so that we're actually doing some of the hands-on kind of work that I, as a parole officer back in the 70s and 80s, used to have the time to do. So we're going to also study that to see whether that makes a difference for offenders in terms of recidivism or not.
Mr. Johnson, refresh my memory on how many folks come out of the county system every year. I know we've heard how many kind of come through DOC institutions in a year, but I have a sense of how many come through the counties. My sense is it's a lot more.
Yeah, I do. And you're absolutely right. It's 142,000 people who are on some form of probation in the state of Minnesota. That's misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felony level probation. I can recall that the county of Hennepin has somewhere around 30,000 people on probation supervision. And I'll just let you know that there is a document that's on our public website right now. If you go to our website, what is it now?
doc.state.mn.us.
There is a link to a probation survey report that was done in 2006 that has all of those numbers broken down for every county in the state, as a matter of fact.
Gary, of that 142,000, that doesn't include supervised release?
Yes.
It does include.
No. No, those are probation.
How many are on supervised release?
Yeah, somewhere around 442. I don't have that number committed to memory, but we have about 9,200 inmates at this point. We release over 6,000 offenders every year, so those are people who are coming out on supervised release and are recycling through our parole violations and coming out for a second time.
So you said there's 4,200 people on supervised release or 42,000?
4,200.
4,200. Okay.
So the number of people who are on probation is vastly larger than the number of people on supervised release. The last thing I want to mention is that we're also working with the Annie E. Casey Foundation to do some expanding of community involvement in the three pilot counties that we have as Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted counties. And we've submitted a proposal to the Casey Foundation, and we're waiting for a response to that proposal. That will probably fund us to the tune of about $150,000. So we've got around $600,000 of foundation and grant money that we're also able to work with, along with what we received in our appropriation this year. Okay. So, I mean, I took much more time than I thought I'd take. But
very good. Well, we asked you questions. So. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Dan, you want to give maybe a 10-minute overview of what...
I'll be very brief, Representative Pamar, but if there are questions specifically about the network, I'd defer them to Steve Thomas. But for those of you who are not familiar, last year a piece of legislation passed that Gary referenced as offender-centered. And it basically came about at the urging of a number of nonprofit and community programs that partnered together. Those partners were North Point, Twin Cities Rise, Family Housing Fund of Minneapolis-St. Paul, Summit Academy, the African American Men's Project, the Medica Health Plans, as well as RS Eden. And the thought was that by coming together and putting together a benefit set of those services most commonly addressed and needed by offenders, but not often effectively delivered in tandem with each other because of the silo way of funding and the way that we look at people at diagnostics as a diagnosis as opposed to individuals, that we could, in fact, deliver a better product. And there was a $1.6 million appropriation for 2 years for that last year. And I, it's a little bit delicate because I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm on the board of the network and there's still a competitive bidding process that's open and there's no guarantee that that group is going to get the money that they lobbied for. But the idea is that you know, offenders are more than offenders. They tend to be mentally ill. They tend to be chemically dependent. They tend to be chronically homeless. They tend to be chronically unemployed. They have physical health problems, and we assign them ownership to whichever we assign ownership for them to whatever door they walk through first. So if you walk through the corrections door, corrections owns you, and it's incumbent on you, particularly when you get in the community, if you need mental health services, to try and find those and coordinate them. If you need behavioral health or chemical health services, to find those. And as a result, we've got people who, by definition, whose lives are chaotic Now we've got them trying to jump back and forth between multiple systems that by themselves are difficult to access for people who don't have chaotic lives and virtually impossible for people that do. And the idea behind this is driven in part, you know, by best practices as I outlined in the Urban Institute study, and I don't like that term, but I use it here, and by a growing recognition that offender reentry is potentially one of the biggest public safety problems that we have on the horizon and have had for some time. You know, when I became chair of the Sentencing Commission in 1982, there weren't 800 people in prison, there were 1,800. And now there are 9,100. And in 1980, in this country, we released a total of 192,000 people out of prison for all 50 states. This year, we'll approach 700,000. Well, we've put into place, and one thing I want to touch on very briefly, is we talked a little bit about the case plan. Well, when we directed resources into the inside part of the equation by sending people to prison, we had to get them from somewhere. And, you know, we didn't raise taxes that much to quadruple the size of our prison population, so we took them from other places. You know, we don't do the comprehensive case plans that we once did. We have higher ratios of offenders to supervising agents than we ever have in the past, and we rely on checkboxes and technology for things that humans used to do. You know, we now have electronic monitoring. That's the current magic bullet. And I run electronic monitoring, so I don't want to detract from it too much, but it doesn't take the place of a probation officer. We do background checks before we even let people into to interview for a job or an apartment or a place to live, that, you know, people used to have to sit down face to face, look people in the eye and say, you know, who are you? What can you bring to the equation? What are you going to do? And what are your qualifications? Now we, you know, I digress just a minute. I was watching TV the other night and there was a rug cleaning company, a commercial. I think it was Stanley Steamer, if I'm not mistaken. It was a 30-second commercial which cost a couple hundred thousand dollars to run in the middle of prime time. Not once did they say anything about how well they cleaned your rug. In that whole commercial, they didn't say squat about how well they cleaned your rug. They said, we do background checks and drug tests on every one of our employees. You will know when they come into your house that they, you know, are squeaky clean. Doesn't matter if your carpets are, your carpet cleaners are. And, you know, it bordered on the ridiculous because, you know, I mean, we know that people that don't have criminal records commit crimes. Otherwise, we'd stop at some point. But that's where we've gotten to with, we've gone with to a degree where we rely on quick and easy solutions as opposed to the kinds of comprehensive case plans that are talked about here. In any event, we came up, we being the community groups that work with offenders, with this idea of trying to create something on a service provider level that really couldn't be created on a government level, and that was a true partnership between those groups that served offenders and yet got their money and their resources and their referrals from different parts of the system. And the jury's still out. I mean, it's a project that received $450,000 from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for startup. It's got some money from Hennepin County. It has some grants out, and it certainly will be applying for this. But it's in the proving stage. I mean, our goal is to prove that we can have a better mousetrap and then to change the system that buys mousetraps piece by piece and try and make it so that, you know, that we remove some of the silos at the state level and have all funding be offender-centered as opposed to corrections, mental health, chemical dependency. And in any event, the second piece of what I was supposed to talk about here today is some of the challenges faced by the nonprofit community or the communities that serve offenders. And I'll go through very, very quick a laundry list of recommendations that we have. One is to create a sustainable funding subsidy for transitional housing for ex-offenders. Housing for ex-offenders is tremendously problematic. We have liability on landlords in some cases if they knowingly rent to an ex-offender and that offender offends. We don't have as much of a housing crunch as we had in the 90s, but it's still the case that if you got an ex-offender and a non-ex-offender applying for an apartment, you know, the decision generally gets made before either one of them has to stand in front of the landlord. Yet we have in place our statewide agency that deals with the issue of long-term homelessness. Well, coming out of prison after being locked up for 20 years doesn't count as long-term homeless, even if you have no place to go, unless you were homeless and met the criteria before you went in the institution. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think should be addressed. HUD, definition of long-term, of homeless, not even long-term homeless, homeless. If you're getting released from a correctional institution, you're not homeless, even if you have no place to go. Those are things that I think we should look at. In terms of jobs and other things, we would recommend that you expand the protections offered under Minnesota Statute 364. That's a law that was passed in 1971. Alan Speer, I believe, was the chief author. And it basically says that for public employment, if I work in government or any public arena and I want to discriminate against you because of the crime that you committed in terms of the job you're applying for, I have to prove that the crime relates to the job. I can't just say you're a felon. I mean, if you're a pedophile, I can always keep you from working in a daycare facility. If you're an embezzler, I can always keep you from working in a bank. But if you're an embezzler and I say you can't be a ditch digger, then I've violated the law. And we would recommend that get expanded from public entities, possibly to private entities, or at the very least to entities, private entities that do work for the government, so as not to make the employment world smaller for people with criminal records. Many states have gone and created a certificate of rehabilitation. There were several expungement bills last year, some that got some play, some that didn't. But, you know, for myself anyway, one of the most creative options that's out there is a certificate of rehabilitation, which the state can create and set whatever criteria it wants on it. You can have a certificate of rehabilitation that excludes certain offenders. I mean, you can have a certificate of rehabilitation that isn't accessible till somebody's been off supervision for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. You can set whatever criteria you want, but once they get that, at least in one state, and I believe it's Connecticut, they've gone so far as to say that to discriminate against someone who has one of those, to say, we're not going to hire you, we're not going to give you a place to live, ties into civil rights legislation, and there are penalties for it. I would recommend that we look at that. Chicago has recently limited liability for negligent hiring for those businesses who knowingly employ ex-offenders. I mean, if you have someone I run a business for ex-offenders. If somebody comes and applies for a job and I know I'm going to be held accountable for their behavior, I'm going to think twice before employing them. Makes all the sense in the world on one level, but on the other hand, if nobody employs them and they can't get a job and they can't find a place to live and they're not afraid of going to prison because they've been there, then that makes no sense. That puts us all at risk. And Chicago, I believe that Chicago has also created state tax breaks or tax incentives for employers who serve ex-offenders. That's something that I think should be looked at. Another thing is we are all faced with background checks, the likes of which used to be done only for national security. We get them when we apply for credit cards. We get them when we apply for jobs. We get them when we apply for apartments. A lot of times the information that comes out of those is not accurate or it's outdated. There's a whole industry of data miners out there who are, you know, not right now at 4 o'clock, but probably at 3 o'clock, they were sitting down on the first floor of the government center checking everybody that was on the court calendar for that day, and that went into a computer somewhere. Well, if somebody was found not guilty, if the charges were dropped, if the prosecutor chose not to issue charges, that data still remains. And it's accurate data because as of 3 o'clock this afternoon, it was accurate data. Even though it might not be accurate tomorrow morning, at the time when they mined the data, it was accurate. So consequently, they can hide behind it's not inaccurate data because it was accurate at that moment in time, even though we have people who've never been convicted of a crime who are being punished through exclusion from jobs and apartments because of an arrest that did not result even in a prosecution, much less a conviction. We recommend it, and CrimNet is down with this as well, that we eliminate access to arrest data where arrest doesn't result in a conviction to all but law enforcement and corrections. That we examine, and I know that there's a committee to do this, and modify the collateral consequences that have been legislatively created. I mean, we have 200 pieces of, we have 200 sanctions just in state law that says if you have a felony, you cannot do this, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. And every one of them may well have made sense when we did them, but collectively it's like dying from 1,000 paper cuts. You know, you only bleed a little bit from each one of the cuts, but with 1,000 of them, you bleed to death pretty quick. We've made the world so small through those collateral sanctions for people that many of them can't find employment. And we've taken jobs from some people. I mean, I can tell you about chemical dependency counselors or nurses, in fact, who were working at the time we made changes to Chapter 245C, the background check legislation, stopped working for a while, came back with no intervening criminal behavior, tried to get their jobs back, and were told that they were excluded permanently from ever working in their chosen careers. That needs to be fixed. And, you know, the tough ones are to fund enough supervising agents to bring caseload sizes down to 1980 levels. I don't think that'll happen. I'm a realist. It costs too much money. But I think that we have to examine how far we've gone in the other direction. You know, I can remember times when caseloads were like 1 to 35, 1 to 40. You have supervising agents today who have caseloads of 120 people. You know, there may be separated by classification, but we have agents who wouldn't recognize somebody they supervised if they got in an elevator with them. I mean, there's something wrong with that. And to consider expanding, and this is something that some won't necessarily agree with, but we have a tremendous success story in the Challenge Incarceration Program. I mean, it works. We're dealing with a select group of offenders. They're treated in prison. They're supervised up the wazoo, and they are, you know, they're held extremely accountable in the community, and the results are exceptional. They get some play out of that. They get an early out for participating in it. We've expanded that to include people in the new, the methamphetamine program. What do we, PAR? Corrections Early Release Program. And I would suggest that as a mechanism for funding this, and having been chair of the Sentencing Commission during the most rapid expansion in criminal sentences in the history of our state, I would tell you that there was no magic in 1989 when we doubled sentences for everything from what severity level 7 and below in the sentencing guidelines. I would recommend that we expand those early release opportunities to some other crimes than just those that fit challenge incarceration, those that fit methamphetamine parameters, and, you know, even if you take 6 months and you make it discretionary, you save enough money to pay for an effective reentry program.
Thank you very much. Just before we open it up here, just wanted to the tax break thing. We currently have that. Like, Gary, I mean, corporations currently can apply for tax breaks.
Yes.
Is that all?
Well, federally you can. There's a
statewide. We have a statewide.
I
was reading in my lunchtime reading of the of reentry here that we have a six that their employer can deduct a percentage of the first $6,000 in wages. I don't know. That's a tax credit that Minnesota corporations are offered. But I just have a quick question, and we'll open it up for discussion about the 10 possible areas we want to work on. But and you know how supportive I am of the reentry bill and what we're doing here. But I'd just like you to respond to this. And Steve, you're welcome to also. But I was reading last night, and maybe you've
a good trip novel.
I have that too. But that's on when I'm on vacation. This research that was done on by the Vera Institute of Justice on Project Greenlight in New York in 2002-2003, which was intended to be an innovative reentry program by providing intense in-prison services during the last 60 days of inmates' incarceration, post-incarceration. It sounds like they were doing some of the same things that you are proposing to do, assuming you would get the grant. And they had an experimental research design, and so part of the population went into the Greenlight program, the other one went into Transitional Services Program, which is the basic programming that they've always done. And the more extensive reentry model had more recidivism than... are you familiar with this?
I'm not. But I would caution Representative Paymar. There's a phenomenon that takes place when you increase services, and that's that you have more contact with people and you have more opportunities to generate technical violations. I would ask if that breaks down new offenses versus technical violations. I mean, when we went to kind of widening the net and we started adding sanctions upon sanctions upon sanctions, we had people that, you know, by being in contact with large numbers of people, they were more likely to miss appointments with agents, they were more likely to get tested more regularly on UAs, and maybe this should have always been the case, but they were more likely to have a dirty UA, and they were more likely to come up against other technical violations. And not to minimize technical violations, but there is a difference between that and a new crime.
A question that I would have about that is, if what they were measuring was a reentry program that provided services as opposed to a reentry program that provided intense supervision, that finding has been replicated over and over, that if what you're doing is looking really, really hard and sending agents to the house and all that, but you're not providing the kind of support that the network has been talking about or whatever, that kind of looking, scrutiny, having, you know, probation officer on their tail, that is really useless and very expensive. So I don't know if that's what they were considering.
Yeah, I maybe we'll need to. One of the things that I was hoping we could do for the next meeting is to bring in someone from the university or some of more of the academic types who have really done some national research on all of this, because I think we're all here. I think we want to do this right, and whatever we do is going to cost an enormous amount of money. And if we're moving towards the direction of reentry in a different way, I think it behooves us to have as much information as possible. So, okay, so. It's already 5 after, and some people haven't talked. Would anyone like to, anything you'd like to add at this point? Okay.
I seem to be talking a lot.
Go ahead.
I just did want to mention that the commission and is staffing the collateral sanctions committee that was funded by the legislature this year, and that a number of the recommendations that Dan touched on will be coming out of that committee in the final report. To extend 364 has been so completely gutted and destroyed by subsequent legislation that it's almost meaningless. But to take that kind of policy and extend it to private employers is important. We have talked about certificates of rehabilitation, also a related thing, which is certificate for release from disability. That is, release from disability. That, you know, technically you're not supposed to be a cab driver, but this entity has, the judge or whoever it is, has reviewed this, is giving you a certificate saying you can be a cab driver. All of those certificates of rehabilitation are really important because they trump data miners. You know, they essentially say, okay, so we know all this stuff. And here's what some law agency has to say about it. They need to be tied with relief from liability for employers. So often the tie-in is if you hire someone who has such a certificate, you cannot be sued either because you knew the stuff that they're being relieved from or because you didn't know it. That is that record that some state entity has said is not of significance cannot be the basis for a lawsuit at any point. It is beginning to look important to start calling back from the internet records. I feel guilty because I was on the executive committee of the Hennepin Court when we talked about what records to put on the internet years ago. And basically what we said is, well, they're all public records, so we put everything on. So now we put on court dockets and everything but the kitchen sink. Some states have realized that because of the misuse of that information, which shouldn't be weighted as it's being weighted, they're calling back those records. So, you know, just making a decision that certain low-level records that are now thrown out there are not going to be published. That they're public records. If people want to go down and see them, they can, but you don't have to put it up on the screen. We are going to be looking at those permanent bars to employment in 245C. Those are the thing that Dan referred to that say something like, if you've got this kind of conviction, you never ever can be a nurse or whatever. And DHS really clearly would like to have the discretion they had for years without, you know, any huge mayhem ensuing. And I guess the one thing that I would add is that I hope, too, that the committee will be looking at the notion of reducing convictions. You know, we wouldn't quite have the scope of the problem we do if we came up with a really coherent mandatory diversion program. And there is a guy from the state of Virginia, the head of their sentencing commission, really actuarial guy, who I want to have come here in the fall at some point to talk about the screening they do to divert people. So, I mean, you know, the idea would be our population hasn't changed much in all these years. Our crime rate hasn't changed much in all these years. What has changed is that we're convicting more and more and more and more people of crimes, and maybe we could cut that back and still protect the public.
Well,
what kind of case flows do supervised release officers have now in the DOC program?
Contempt of supervised release is a mandatory 15.
Supervised release is 15, yeah. Intensive supervised release. I think it varies from county to county or rural versus urban. Hennepin County, I think, has caseload sizes now of around 70, I believe. That's an educated guess, but I can certainly find that number out. I know Andy had his hand
up. Ramsey at 70 to 80 for every supervised release agent. Intensive, because that's state-funded, and there's 15, we adhere to the maximum caseload. But a regular supervised release, somebody coming out of prison for which, on typical day, probably 400 or 500 of those,
The caseloads are 70 to 85 range.
Is there, do you maintain any information about just the success rates for not violations, not violating your conditions of your release with as the size of
The caseload grows?
Caseload increases?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know that we've tracked it that in that kind of detail. Well, we need to do a better job of research with not just recidivism, but what works and what doesn't work, what kind of programs are more successful than others, and how is supervision done in different ways, and is there a better way to do it?
I think that's one of the things that I think it's important we have information to look at that kind of stuff, because it's clear they've done research in other places to show that, as the number of officers on the streets increases, there's a corresponding drop in crime. I mean, there's an economic part to this equation that you can start to look at if you have kind of information. If we know that the failure rate increases dramatically as the caseload grows, I mean, there's an economic reason to lower the caseload. So, I mean, I think that's part of the things that we have to understand, I think, as legislators and as policymakers, how those things interrelate to each other.
I agree.
Okay, anyone have anything?
I was going to add, Mr. Chairman, that I have heard a number, I don't have it with me today, but there is a certain percentage of new prison admissions are because of technical violations for people that were on supervised release. That's a fairly high percentage of new prison admissions each year.
Okay.
Yeah, that information, I think, is in that probation survey, that 2006 probation survey. It would be at the back of that survey where supervised release is reviewed.
So it's roughly, I think, around a third of our new admissions are technical violators. Mr. Chair, if I could, to Dan's point earlier, the one thing that you will see if you take a look at the challenge incarceration report is an ordinarily high number of technical violators, while the people committing new felonies is way reduced. Technical violations are higher. And I think that speaks to the fact that they have 15 on their caseload, they're seeing them three or four times a week. And a technical violation, I always say, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's tuning somebody up, it's getting out in front of a problem. And, you know, I just think that we should pay attention to this particular report, because it's a well-done report. The problem with it is that it deals with the population from the early 90s. It doesn't really catch the methamphetamine population. We're going to do an update of that same population group, only it's going to be the methamphetamine population. The other piece that is really interesting is out of the women now, since we sent them up to Togo for their challenge incarceration piece, there's only been one violation in over 18 months, which I think is extraordinary. So, you know, again, I think it's that the problem I have with the study that the Vera did is when you talk about starting reentry 60 days before release, you can't do squat in 60 days. You really got to start reentry with that case plan the day they come in. And that is the variable I think that's important in CIP. If we start working with those people the day they come in, it's a highly structured program, they're release treated, they got a house, they got a place to live, they got a job, they got a mentor or support, and they got that incredible supervision. And, you know, again, I get back to what Dan and I often call the recipe for success, and it really is, I think that's a great place to start.
The CIP is for drug offenders, when we're talking about. I mean,
by and large, it's drug offenders.
So, I don't know. It's just, we should just look at all of the research and find out.
We'll respond. We'll be ready to respond to that next time we meet.
Would it make sense, since it's already 4:15 now, to go through what the bill stated that the working group would work on and try to narrow it down, or do we want to... I'm just afraid that we'll start meeting and we'll have great conversations, and I don't want that to happen. I don't want to waste people's time. we've already... I could read them again. Melanie, you don't have this list so everyone could see them, do you, by any chance?
I have the next question. I can read them again.
I could read them again. I mean, just, I don't know if we just want to say yay or nay to some of these or how we want to do it. What's the best thing to do? The bill talked about DOC's roles and the DOC's role in offender reentry. Well, okay. We've already done that. Post-release planning, education, treatment, housing, and employment. So I think that that was some of what Dan was talking about. So just sort of chime in here if you think we're going too far here. And that housing for offenders upon release from prison, including offender housing plans, the need for the placement of halfway houses. One thing we didn't talk about is the role in assisting offenders with mental health services and drug treatment. That was in the bill. Do we want to take on the drug weight thresholds and controlled substances? That is hugely controversial.
That's my job.
The chairman, maybe Isabel has something to say about that.
Is that one we think? No, really, I'm serious.
We already have one going on that one.
Well, that's right. You are actually dealing with that.
Right? Well, no. That's the buzzsaw one that we're trying to stay away from. I mean, it's important to be done. I don't mean to be silly about it, but
not necessarily not the here. As it relates to reentry.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there may be better places to look.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Going, yeah.
As it regards the housing and other resources in the community, I think that's a critical piece of solid reentry that this work group should look closely at.
Okay.
Because I think we have newer resources available for larger numbers of offenders than we used to.
And they all concentrated in.
So would it be helpful at our next meeting if we did agree to some of these, for instance, housing or employment, that we bring appropriate, I don't know who the appropriate people would be, but to have more resources at this table when we discuss those issues?
Maybe since collateral sanctions committee is focused exclusively on employment, not by any means that the committee is going to get to the bottom of that, you know, we might want to focus on housing. And maybe see what comes out of, see what we manage to pull together out of that committee on employment before this group gets into it.
Okay. And I just invite anyone from staff if you have anything that you want to add here as we're going along here, please do.
Certainly, maybe have some providers who are providing housing. I mean, I'm on the board, and Dan probably could talk to us further of 180 degrees, and one of the things that we're finding is that, I think as Senator Higgins was alluding to, there are very few places now you can put new developments for housing ex-offenders, whether in a concentrated area, and even if we have providers who are interested in doing that, there's no place to do them, so the few that we have out there is what's remaining. So
siting is a serious issue, I think.
So maybe, Melanie, we can try to find some of the providers. Okay.
I think we'll bring some local government folks in that discussion.
Okay, local government folks.
Yeah, I think that's where your biggest obstacle is. I mean, we have about 370 units of housing. We don't call it offender housing. We call it sober supportive housing. We try and focus on the positive as opposed to the negative. And it's been okay because, you know, who gravitates to that housing is people who have had problems. So we actually have about 70 to 80% of people that we have in that housing that are people on supervised release. But we've had the benefit of HUD Section 8 to provide subsidy for those folks. And that's virtually gone at this point. So as we move towards looking to other vehicles, whether it be corrections or some type of subsidy administered by the MHFA, you know, we have to be more open in the fact that we're taking offenders. And that runs counterintuitive to people's ideas about public safety and property values. To the most of those decisions on the ability to make to locate a facility take place at the local level. Very little of it takes place at the state level. But we do have all kinds of information, not just anecdotal information, that, you know, not only does this type of housing not compromise public safety, it actually increases it in those areas where they've been located, unless you try and put someplace out in Maple Grove or whatever, and that wouldn't be, even though there are people that try and push that idea, it doesn't work well. And it hasn't had any negative impact on property values.
Do your 700 homes or apartments or whatever it is, are they clustered geographically in any locations? Or I'm interested in your comment. You said that with some would like to see them in Maple Grove. I don't know if you want to put them in Maple Grove, but I guess the question is, criminals come from every place,
right?
And it seems like we need to think about making sure that criminals go back every place so that we're not just kind of...
I agree with that, Representative Eastland, but in terms of housing, there's a whole continuum of need and a continuum of responses to housing, meeting people where they are. We focus on developing what we call intentional communities. And in an intentional community, you try and get a very simplistic view of it is you provide services to the community and the community becomes a change agent for the individual. Not altogether unlike how most people got into trouble. But the idea, you get a critical mass of people, you have them sign on to an to behavioral and pro-social expectations and beliefs as part of their lease agreement, and then you hold them accountable to that, and you get them to hold each other accountable to that. So in our units, we have 124 people in one place, we have 61 in another, we have 26 families in one, 25 families in another, we'll be doing 32 units on the north side of Minneapolis. And to do those large numbers, you put them where you have large numbers of people coming from. Scattered sites, I mean, you wouldn't want to put a 100-unit building in Edina, for instance, because they would basically say you're importing criminals and the people in Edina aren't going to live with that. By putting a 100-unit building in Phillips, there's 100 people already in Phillips that can fill that building, so you're actually providing a service and a benefit to the community.
Okay, so it seems like there's agreement that housing would be a good agenda item for this group. What about...
Just on that issue, I think it would be important, though, to have somebody, if you're having somebody from local government, just somebody from, let's say, the non-metro area, or at least not from Hennepin and Ramsey, because some of these folks, our experience has been, these folks end up, as Dan said, going back to the same environment where they were and where they got into trouble to begin with. And that's been our experience in when we see people again and again in our caseload. And a lot of times they don't have anywhere to go, any other housing to go to, so they end up back in the same place they were with their buddies who, you know, are also mm-hmm. having trouble. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know Senator Higgins has this concern about this concentration, I think we do have to kind of look at, you know, what are some other options for some of these places like Anoka County and Washington County and, you know, go up to Stearns County, places like that where a lot of these people are returning to. So we just hope we don't kind of concentrate on Hennepin and Ramsey alone.
The Department of Corrections has a housing directory,
that is also online. It's there for anyone to see, that lists resources, housing resources for those counties around the state. What we found is that we just categorized them by county, and you'd be astounded at the number of counties that have no housing resources at all.
I know it won't. But the other thing that I think that you have to tackle head on, if you're going to deal with housing, and maybe it got said while I was out of the room, it's the whole issue of sex offenders.
Yeah.
I mean, even though our housing takes offenders, we have covenants with each of the neighborhoods we're in that we won't take any sex offenders. And we needed to do that in order to get permission to build in those neighborhoods. On the other hand, sex offenders got to live somewhere if we're not going to have them in prison. And if you've got them on intensive supervised release, where each one of them has to get seen four times a week, and you've got a dozen of them in one place, you know where they are. You got 48 visits to that building per week. You know, that is a saturation of accountability and supervision. Yet, you know, building a place that would take and allow that to be that type of housing, probably the best housing that you could have for that population, but we can't build it anywhere.
Do we want to take that on?
Well, the department has taken that on and taken a number of bruises and bumps because of taking that issue on. I'm the housing program manager for the Department of Corrections, along with what I'm doing with reentry, and citing locations where sex offenders may be part of a housing resource causes great concern for almost every community. So we've had some successes and we've had some failures in trying to site houses where we do, as Dan says, intensive supervised release of those offenders we have in those scattered site locations. And only one quarter of those people that are placed in those resources are sex offenders. Yet it's seen as sex offender housing. And so it's caused us a lot of difficulty.
I mean, this is kind of unrelated to what we're doing here, but I think that we really have done a disservice to this whole issue of sex offenders, because in the public eye, sex offender is a sex offender. It doesn't matter if they're level one, level three, it doesn't matter. And the data is out there that says the vast majority of these people can make a readjustment back to real life, and we have basically destroyed that option for them. And I think when we look at reentry, I think that's one of the pieces that we should look at. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think it has to happen over a longer period of time. And we have to undo this paranoia that we've created in our society that a sex offender is somehow going to attack the first female that walks by. I mean, it isn't true. It's just plain not true. And it frustrates me. I mean, I get umpteen letters and phone calls from people. I heard a sex offender moved into the community. Why didn't I hear anything about it? It's just like, it's frustrating.
10 miles.
Well,
yeah.
I really applaud you for that statement and understanding, Representative Eastland. I mean, I am fond, as an elderly woman, of saying, you know, sex offenses are common as dirt. The fact of the matter is, here isn't a woman I know who has not been on the receiving end of something that is, in fact, criminal behavior. I think it's fine that there are laws against these things and so on, but we have lost all ability to be reasonable and have any kind of perspective on this, and the conversation or the statements of what the facts are have to come from somebody sometime. If this group wants to do that, I would certainly join.
Well, the other thing that I would just add to that is, you know, sex offenders, first off, we use that term, we throw it around, you know, and it's like we used to throw the term rape around. It conjures up one image in people's mind, but a sex offender is everybody from the person who violently penetrates a young child to the 19-year-old who's immature, who has consensual sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend or cousin or whatever. And yet we do throw them all together. And, you know, but what we've done is we've created a situation where for an offender to get out and stay out, he or she almost has to isolate, you know, to be by themselves somewhere, try and keep as low profile as possible, and just kind of stay underneath the radar. Well, my experience, and Jeff's on the board of a program that serves more sex offenders than we do, at least provide services to them, is that sex offenders as a group, the worst thing that you can do for them is have them isolate. You know, they are, you know, they're not a collegial population. It's not like burglars where we sit around and talk about, you know, who opened the best safe or whatever. You know, they don't like to do those kinds of things. They don't like to be reminded of things. And if they're off by themselves somewhere, they talk themselves into all kinds of bad stuff. You know, yet we set in place a system where that's the only way that they can live, is off by themselves, all by themselves.
In fact, there's a Colorado study that shows that by grouping sex offenders together in housing, they police each other.
Well, you know, just in the given the time frame here, so this housing, I think we should include sex offenders. I'm just wondering if, either for the next meeting or the following meeting, that we can somehow find out, and I don't, we have resources here, but what best practices are going on around the country rather than us trying to figure this out. I mean, Dan, you guys probably know some of this, but I mean, the idea, I think, for this working group is for us to have recommendations for possible legislation for the next legislative session. And like I said, we may not vote on it, but I would like to see that happen. So I don't know, Melanie, Libby, can we sort of work with trying to find out best practices nationally so we're not reinventing? Maybe there are some states that are doing some things that we should be replicating. Okay. What about... the issue of an early discharge committee or parole board? Jack Davies, I think we invited him, but I don't know what if he had.
I guess I feel strongly that this is an area that we need to explore. I mean, I don't know where we should be going. I know there's a variety of views on this at this table. That we've had a number of discussions, but I think we do agree that at sentencing time in a courtroom, not all the information about how a person is going to respond to prison and treatment and reentry into society is known, and I think there needs to be some mechanism, some place in our system, for certain inmates who demonstrate the ability to not need another 2 or 3 years behind bars to be able to figure out how to make that happen. I just think it makes good economic sense, and it makes good social sense, and I don't know how we do that, and maybe a parole board is not the right way, but some mechanism needs to exist. And I see the way it's written here, an early discharge committee. I don't know how that committee would work or how they would get authority to alter a judge's sentence, but I think we need to talk about those things and see if there aren't some avenues to at least do it on a small scale to start with, to see if we can make this work. Because, I mean, there have to be people that a year after they've been admitted, it's like they shouldn't be here anymore. They're gonna go downhill if they stay here. And we need to respect that, and I think, and do our best to try to get these people back to their families and to jobs and to being productive citizens. So that's my view.
Does the reentry court that's listed on that list fit in that whole discussion somewhere, or is that meant to be something else?
Gary Carter, do you remember the reentry courts? I thought you were the one who maybe gave me that information about some states experimenting with reentry courts,
I'm not expert in this, but what I remember, I think, is that reentry courts are kind of based on the model of a drug court.
so that you, when you have people released, they are going back to judicial review to take a look at how they are doing on release status. So I think that's what's meant by reentry court.
It is what's meant by reentry courts, and I think in some states they have a little different situation than we do here, whereas the DOC would put somebody out on supervised release and monitor them. In other states, they go back before a judge for violations once they're on release, and the judge would, like in drug court, have, you know, services available to them. So I'm not sure it totally works with our particular system here for having the court involved, because the court isn't really the one who's doing violations on the release status from the department in our state. But I could look a little further into that if you want to.
Yeah. And Gary Carver, I should say, can you also do some looking into that reentry court? Dennis, I'd be curious to your thoughts about us tackling this. I mean, you and I have had conversations about this also, and I know it's controversial, and...
I think that Minnesota has, you know, since the early 80s when we went to guidelines, has really, I think, done a remarkable job, despite everything. Despite everything, we still have one of the lowest incarceration rates in the nation. We really do reserve our expensive prison beds for those people who have probably earned their way in. Having said that, I agree with Representative Eastland. I think that one size doesn't always fit all. I think that the notion that we have to have a meth manufacturer who's manufacturing for a habit and 60, 70 months in prison is kind of over the top. So my taking a long time to say that, again, I go back to the CIT model, and Isabel and I have had lots of discussion about how we might approach this. But I think that carrot and stick thing for some offenders really works. The accountability on the back end really, really works. I think that research bears that out. I do think that we've lived with guidelines for a long time, and any good system, I think, has to be fluid and dynamic and willing to change. And I know that guidelines is wrestling with the drug sentencing issue right now, and I think it's an important issue. I would question, though, whether or not we can do everything that's in front of us in that too. I just think that is a huge, huge issue, and I'm not saying it's a bad issue. I'm just questioning. I mean, sex offender housing, reentry. I mean, that is a full play. I mean, it's almost Halloween, for God's sake. It's going to be long. We're going to be back in the land of Oz right over here. So.
Shoot for the moon.
When you come back to this.
I agree with Dennis, but I think one of the things that I see as an issue that we should think about here is that we should think about this process. Maybe the players at the table would change over time, but change takes a long time. And if we could, I think, commit to a process of moving from point A to point B over a period of time, maybe we're going to go only from point A to, you know, 8.1 this session. But I think we should keep in mind the larger scope of where we need to go if we're really going to effectively improve the situation in our state. I would encourage us that, you know, we're probably not going to be able to take on everything. Maybe there's just two or three things on here. But I think we should, at the same time, think in terms of the whole picture and of a kind of a scope and sequence for where we want to get to. I just think to do that and to do it just in bits and pieces that don't relate, it gets to be real awkward. So I would encourage this, something that would resemble this group, continue over a long period of time.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that just the fact that this group is convened in talking about it is progress. I think, you know, maybe we don't take on sex offenders this year. I mean, I threw that out there. But, you know, if we could come up with a plan for where we wanted to be and then take it one step at a time to get there, keeping in mind that, you know, this is something that we might be able to accomplish this session. Because, you know, I think trying to accomplish it all at once, even though that tends to be my way of doing things, can oftentimes be a recipe for failure. You know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And, you know, we didn't get to where we're at. I mean, we've spent the past 25 years taking the best correction system in the state and pushing it. It's not going to fix it overnight.
Well, I'm really not trying to suck up Representative Eastland, but, you know, I agree with that, too. I think if we're talking about developing, growing, healthy people, that's a very different thing from fixing cars. You know, we've done this fixing thing, which implies or suggests to voters and our various constituents that we can do a repair that's kind of neat and whatever. That's not the way people are, and we do have to start talking differently about our work. You know, we have to be willing to say to people, we made an investment in the state's future. You know, we made this kind of move that because we studied and we decided it for you that it will pay off and it'll be good for us in the long haul. We have to start talking that way instead of saying we took care of whatever it was, you know, this year. And I agree, and I think all of this is, I mean, it's not going to take forever, but you do have to have a longer view.
Well, the other thing that I was going to say is if you wanted to break up into committees, I don't know how other people here, but if they were looking at, you know, putting this in digestible chunks, I certainly would be willing to spend the time necessary to do this.
That might be an option, because I don't know how we could do this in 3 or 4 meetings left before session starts and the holidays. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if we might consider, it seems like everything on the list that we looked at, except for the issue of the drug issue and the sex offenders, are things that are worth tackling.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe at the beginning of our next meeting we can set priorities about these are the top three, but maybe deal with them one at a time, like spend our next meeting all on the issue of housing or something, or re-enter, and get to the point where we make a recommendation, and then we move on to the next subject, because if you have 2-hour meetings and we have complicated subjects and outside resources coming in, it will take a long time.
I like that, too, and I do endorse the notion of, and I hate committees that go on forever, but I agree with Dan, it took us 25 years to get here. And I think the fact that we've got policymakers that are willing to come to the table and talk about these important issues. Corrections can't do it alone. The community can't do it alone. Isabel can't do it alone. We really do need all the right people to discuss these issues and come up with reasonable recommendations. And they're all important. I think that's why they're in the bill. The one thing that I point to, though, if you just take a look at our population, I think it's 24% now are drug offenders, and 18% are sex offenders. That's almost half of our prison population with those two offender groups. And if we're going to focus energy and get some what we call quick hits and quick results, I think those two populations, as we look at them in relation to reentry, are important.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that, and I don't know that we have talked about it yet, but somewhere in the mix, we should talk about mental illness.
About what?
Mental illness. I mean, I 18% sex offenders, 24% drug offenders. How many people do we have on psychotropic meds?
Over
25% of male offenders in our prison system are
women. 36%
we put that,
women,
put
it's
that.
More like 40 to 42.
We have that in the bill.
Okay.
So
juveniles,
juveniles we have in the bill.
And the 24% was just drug offenders, not offenders in prison who have drug problems.
No, it's everybody, I believe.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah just right. People that are convicted of a drug offense.
Having drug problems.
The other thing is 42% of our homeless population have been in prison, too. That compares to 7% as recently as 1992, I think. So.
What did you say the percentage of mentally ill?
The percentage of mentally ill is probably much higher. Those diagnosed and on meds is about 25% for men and 40% for women.
This is in my little PowerPoint presentation. It's 25% for males are on some psychotropic medication.
No. There are others who are undiagnosed. Yeah. Those are just the diagnosed ones.
And it's 40 to 42%, I believe, for females.
Isn't a lot of those disparities?
In terms of mental illness?
In terms of the number on the meds. And that's quite a bit of...
I think they're quicker to prescribe for women.
Is that it?
I mean, it's just my experience.
I think it's related to the victimization that women are subject to much more than men. There's nearly 100% of the women at Shakopee have been brain injured. It's an astounding statistic. And the number for males in our prison system is around 80% have some level of brain injury. So the issue of abuse, physical abuse, is also a serious problem with our corrections population.
I've only got a few minutes here, and I wanted to just... So I think if I understand the consensus is, except for the issue of the drug sentencing, which, well, we'll put that lower on the priority, but it sounded like we start off with housing perhaps and see where we go next, whether we want to look at parole boards or the issue of those inmates with mental health problems. We could sort of try to prioritize this list a little bit better for the next meeting, and maybe Melanie could even do a little talking with working group members and see if we can't come to consensus. So we have that list. But I'm wondering also about expanding this working group. I don't see anybody here from the county attorney's office. Melanie, were they invited and not here, or what's the deal?
I think not.
I'm sorry?
I think not.
Okay. And because they are in the bill, it says they're supposed to be. Do people think that we should broaden? Kevin.
I think they should be here. There's no question.
Because we start talking about some of these issues, it's going to raise.
You know what? They're going to be weighing in at some point anyway, and so you got to have their perspective on it. So I would suggest that you should have them here.
Okay. And what about law enforcement?
I think it's the same issue. Yeah. You know. I hate to be standing up for prosecutors and cops, but, you know.
Well, they're part of the whole system that makes it work. And
I
talked to Mike earlier. I mean, I think it would make sense to have somebody from the governor's office that would be here, at least actively involved in first-hand information here. I mean, obviously, working with the governor's office is going to be important for anything we do to get it passed, and I think that's... should be important. Yeah, the question I had, one other question just about the number one on the list here, I guess you don't have the list, but the DOC's role in offender reentry. Are there any models around the country where there's any experience? And I mean, the DOC can't do everything. And I mean, and there's a point where they're inside, and they're inside the jurisdiction of our correction system, and there's a point where they aren't. And it seems like our reentry initiative has to bridge that. And I guess I'm kind of interested in trying to understand how we pass the baton and where the jurisdiction of DLC starts, where the jurisdiction of somebody else begins, and how those integrate. I just think that's an important thing to talk about, or else we're still going to have this cliff. They're all boom gone. And I don't know how we address that, but I think that's important to talk about.
Jared, do you want to quickly respond and then?
Well, there is some study and some theory that a case plan is the kind of document that should be passed along beyond correctional supervision, because people who expire from a sentence or a discharge from a sentence don't necessarily leave their problems with the agency. They carry them along with them and are involved with other public service agencies after their corrections sentence is over with, and that case plan could move along to that other agency so that the history and the continuum of service is not interrupted, even though corrections is out of the picture. So.
But it's a good point, and I think it's a challenge that belongs to both community corrections and the department. And I've always said I think the free delivery system is a double-edged sword. I think that it has served us well, and that we keep a lot of lower-level offenders out of prison in the community, and we deal with them at the lowest possible level. On the other end, I think it's convoluted when we're trying to hand that baton to one of a couple of different systems. I think that's part of our challenge with the reentry initiative, is to make that transition smoother.
Yeah, and I think the state of Michigan has been at the forefront of offender reentry, just based on the numbers of offenders that are in their correctional system and the percentage of state budget that is devoted to those people requires that the state of Michigan do something different with their offenders than they have been doing. So I think they're looking at collaborative work there. We could take a look at what's going on there in the state of Missouri also.
New York, maybe.
I think the Annie Casey Foundation has been involved more recently just in Florida.
Yes.
And I don't know what they're doing there, but I've just read that they're doing something there that's kind of on the cutting edge of reentry stuff. So if we could get some of that information, I just think that data would be helpful.
I think they were trying to rehabilitate the Department of Corrections in Florida.
Can I just ask, for those of you who are here, is our Wednesday afternoons just a good time? Does this work for people by and large?
Two Wednesdays a month it does, and this happens to be one. The first and third Wednesdays don't usually work, so this one just happened to fall out of it. But I think Melanie has sent something out about checking on dates, so I don't know. If we do that,
the first and third work for you?
The first and third are the ones that don't work. This one just happened to be something that was canceled. So.
Okay.
But I can work with Melanie on that. Did you want to meet on a monthly basis, or how?
I'm thinking we want to meet at least another time in September, and then maybe twice in October, and then we'll see where. I realize it's hard for people to do with your schedules, but
okay.
Isabel, it works for you.
What
time? Day for Wednesday,
right
afternoon. Is this enough? Is 2 hours enough time to do this, or? I mean, if we do have...
I guess if you're tackling one topic at a time, like somebody earlier suggested, it might be, if you're going to start talking about housing and mental health and drug counseling, and then you're going to go into parole board and try to squeeze them all in.
If we do housing next time, we probably want to bring some people in here to really address the working group. Right. And
Are housing and employment and some of the things related? No.
They're related in terms of being critical to someone's release. I had success on release.
Yeah, we could combine those.
Well, Isabel's group is working on the collateral sanction, basically around employment.
So I don't know if you want to wait for that report.
We're just
doing employment.
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that you got CrimNet and you got some of the other folks out there working on some of the information. The data harvesters and those things. So that maybe if you were considering that topic, that may be another one of those that there are some other folks working on just to kind of narrow the focus here a little bit too. So,
well, maybe if we spent a little time defining what, you know, the outcomes of our group are, we would define something for the legislative process that will result in reduced, that promotes public safety, reduces prison reentry recidivism, and so on and so forth. And we come up and that becomes our focus, then everything else, the information systems or the whatever, really fall off.
Yeah,
I think.
Good point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does
that work? When's September the 19th?
September the 19th works for me.
I've got my calendar, but I'm assuming it's that. Libby?
Look over there, yeah.
That's not good, is it? All right. So we'll tentatively schedule September the 19th, and I'm in town or not.
Okay,
we'll check in with everybody here and just make sure that I may be out of town that week. I'm not sure. I know. So, but
I know I'm out of town the next week.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you all for coming. I really do think something good is going to come out of this work. It might seem insurmountable, but it's not. And something's going to happen good out of this working group. So thank you all, and thank you all, staff and others who came.
Can we leave this up here?
Oh, yeah. Oh.